Se vasudevaya Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 3, Text 27. Te deva siddha parigita pavitra gata Te deva siddha parigita pavitra gata Ye sarava samadriso bhagavat prapana Ye sarava samadriso bhagavat prapana Tanno pasida taharer garaya biguttan Tanno pasadita harer garaya biguptan Naisam vayam nachavaya prabhavamadande Naisam vayam nachavaya prabhavamadande Te deva siddha parigita pavitra gata Ye sarava samadriso bhagavat prapana Tanno pasida taharer garaya biguptan Naisam vayam nachavaya prabhavamadande Te they Deva by the demigods. Siddha and the inhabitants of Siddhaloka. Parigita sung. Pavitragata, whose pure narrations. Yay, who? Sarava, devotees. Samadrisa, who see everyone equally. Bhagavat-prapana, being surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Tan, them. Na, not. Upasidata, should go near. Hare, of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Gadaya, by the club. Abhiguptan, being fully protected. Na, not. Esham, of these. Vayam, we. Nacha, and also not. Vaya, unlimited time. Prabhavama, are competent. Dande, in punishing. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. My dear servants, please do not approach such devotees, for they have fully surrendered to the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They are equal to everyone, and their narrations are sung by the demigods and the inhabitants of Siddhaloka. Please do not even go near them. They are always protected by the club of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and therefore Lord Brahma and I, and even the time factor, are not competent to chastise them. In effect, Yamaraj warned his servants, my dear servants, despite what you may have done previously to disturb the devotees, henceforward you should stop. The actions of devotees who have surrendered unto the lotus feet of the Lord and who constantly chant the holy name of the Lord are praised by the demigods and the residents of Siddhaloka. Those devotees are so respectable and exalted that Lord Vishnu personally protects them with the club in his hand. Therefore, regardless of what you have done this time, henceforward you should not approach such devotees. Otherwise, you will be killed by the club of Lord Vishnu. This is my warning. Lord Vishnu has a club and chakra to punish devotees. Do not risk punishment. This is my warning. Lord Vishnu has a club and chakra to punish non-devotees. Do not risk punishment by attempting to disturb the devotees. Not to speak of you. If even Lord Brahma or I were to punish them, Lord Vishnu would punish us. Therefore, do not disturb the devotees any further. So that was Prabhupada sort of presenting to us what Yamaraj would be saying to his servants, the Yamadutas. Om Aginatam Anandasya Ginam Ginashalakaya Chakshura Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupakada Mayam Dadati Swapadantikam. So sometimes when Prabhupada was present, he would sometimes have some of his disciples speak while he was there. And for various reasons, he may not have been feeling well, or he just may have wanted to hear, you know, what are these boys actually understanding, whatever. And, of course, they would do that. They had to, you know, they cooperated and they would speak. And while they were speaking, they were always conscious that they were speaking on the instruction, on the request and the instruction of Srila Prabhupada with his permission. And if they were able to say anything worthwhile, it was only by his mercy. So in the same way, I'm speaking here in front of Viraj Maharaj, my senior guard brother, and like almost Shiksha Guru. So I asked his permission earlier, and he said, please go ahead and speak. So I'm mentioning this now as well, so all of you don't think that I'm just some audacious, puffed up person. I am, but please don't think that. Or anyway, at least I did ask. And Giriraj Maharaj gave me his permission to speak in his presence. So, and I hope by his mercy I can say something worthwhile. So, this is a very interesting verse and purport, like, of course, all the verses and purports in the Bhagavatam are. When I read this, the first thing that kind of jumped into my mind was, I was thinking that, wow, this is amazing. You know, here's Yamaraj speaking to the Yamadutas, giving him this instruction. But what is the specific incident that he's, you know, instructing them in relation to? It's they're going to get Ajamil. In other words, they were going to take Ajamil, who was this very, very sinful person, and they were, you know, going to bring his subtle body and soul, I guess both, to Yamaraj for judgment. And, you know, seemed quite an appropriate thing to do. But as we all very well know the story, Ajamil chanted out Narayan, calling out for his youngest son. And on the strength of that, he's being considered here a devotee and eligible to, you know, receive this special concession, you know, of not being punished by the Yamadutas. And I was thinking, wow, he's really getting a lot of mercy. Because if you know, if you stop and think about what he did, I'm not talking about all the sinful things he did, just the devotional thing he did, it wasn't very much. I mean, he was calling out Narayan. And from what I've missed a lot of the classes because I've been, you know, traveling. But from what I remember from, you know, reading this part of the Bhagavatam and all the classes I've heard about it, everybody's in agreement that when he was chanting out Narayan, he was calling out for his son. I don't think any of the commentators, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think any of the commentators state that right from the get-go, he was calling out for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Narayan. From what I'm understanding, all the commentators are in agreement that initially he was calling out for his son, and I believe Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary, makes the comment that after he initially called out for his son, Narayan, that reminded him of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan, who he had worshipped in his younger days. And then, maybe from that point onwards, he was calling out for the actual Narayan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But, even so, it's just, at best, he's mixed. You know, like somebody, you know, if you analyze this, on one level, he's just by mistake, basically. You know, he's just inadvertently saying the name of Supreme Personality of God. And at best, he's like performing mixed devotional service in that he started off just inadvertently calling out the name of the Supreme Personality of God. And then he did it consciously when he realized, you know, he got, oh, wait a second, what am I calling for my son? Let me call for the real Narayan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So my point is that he's getting a tremendous amount of benefit for such a small amount of devotional service. What mercy. You know, he's just doing this little thing. And because of that, Yamaraj is here instructing his servants, the Yamadutas, you know, don't disturb these people. He's being included within this category of devotees that shouldn't be disturbed. You know, I would think that upon hearing these instructions, I would think that, well, that applies for, you know, somebody's performing devotional service very nicely, very favorably for some prolonged period of time. Yeah, you know, those are the people that the Yamadutas shouldn't disturb. But somehow or another, Ajamil is getting the, you know, he's getting the benefit here. He's being included. I mean, it's this incident that which is instigating this Yamaraj giving these instructions to the Yamadutas. So, wow. You know, devotional service is, you know, from this we can understand how powerful, potent, and glorious it is. That even just this little bit of devotional service that's being performed by Ajamil. And, I mean, somebody could almost say, well, how is it even devotional service if he wasn't, you know, if he's just calling out for a son? But anyway, he's getting such a tremendous amount of benefit. And of course, in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, there's that verse, Neha bhikkhamanasto sti prachavaya navijate swapam apyascha dharmasha trayate mahatobaya, that in this endeavor, there is no loss or diminution. By engaging in even a little devotional service protects one from the most dangerous type of fear. And Prabhupada explains in the purport that after receiving the human form of life, one goes back down into the lower species. So it protects one from that. Even if one engages in a little devotional service, that will protect him from that. So my immediate thought after, you know, that was, you know, wow, we have to get out there. We have to get out there. We have to try to give people the opportunity to engage in a little bit of devotional service. Because even if they just engage in a little bit of devotional service, that will guarantee at least they get another human form of life. And look, I mean, just look at Ajamil. He just chanted, initially he was just calling out for his son, Narayan, and maybe he was remembering the Supreme Personality of God, Narayan, maybe not, but he got the benefit of not having to, you know, be dragged by the Yamadutas to hell and be judged by Yamaraj, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he got another opportunity, he got a second chance to continue with this devotional service, and eventually went back to Godhead. So we have to try to, as much as possible, give people the opportunity to engage in some devotional service. Ideally, a lot of devotional service, but at least, if that's not possible, even a little devotional service, and that will enable them to get a human body in their next life. Now, when you think about this, at least sometimes when I think about this, I think, wow, you know, is this really true? I mean, is it, my service is book distribution, so I'm out there all day long and I'm meeting people who aren't devotees. And I have to admit, a lot of the time when I talk to them and everything, at the end of the day, I think to myself, you know, well, I mean, these people didn't seem that bad. I mean, most of the people I met were friendly and, you know, respectful. Some of them took books. Some of them even showed quite a bit of interest. And, you know, they didn't seem like such bad, bad people. You know, I mean, it's not like I'm at the end of the day, driving away and thinking, wow, what a bunch of demons. No, I just think, you know, okay, you know, seem like, you know, ordinary, nice people. And sometimes, you know, so I have to think to myself, well, how is it, you know, but how is it, is it really true that, you know, these people I'm meeting, who seem like, you know, really basically kind of ordinary, nice people, are really going to get such heavy punishment if they don't take the Krishna consciousness? Of course, the answer is yes, because that's, you know, that's our philosophy. That's what the Shastras say. And in an attempt to understand this point, I've tried to, you know, I've come up, just pondered upon it, and I've come up with like a couple different things. Like one analogy that came in my mind when I was trying to understand this point, how is it that these people are really that bad? They're really that sinful? I mean, Krishna says, Namam duskritino mudha papajante naradama. Mayaya pratigyana asuram bhavmashrita. There are four kinds of people who don't surrender unto me. You know, four kinds of miscreants don't surrender unto me, and he names them. You know, so these people are in that category. They're not, you know, if somebody's not surrendering to Krishna, then they're either a mayaya pratigyana naradam. Duskritana mudha, etc. So how was this? Well, one analogy that came to my mind was this. When I was younger, when I was 15 years old, I went to driver's education. I was born and raised in New York, and in New York they had this program where if you took driver's education, you can get your driver's license a year early. So actually, I got it 3 years early, I think. And I took driver's education at 15 years old, and from 15 to 16, I could drive with another licensed driver in the car, and when I was 16, I had a full license. And I could drive. That's the way it worked in New York State. Maybe Archie did the same thing. I don't know. He did. So when I was thinking, when I went to driver's education school, I can never remember one time when the teacher there told me, don't run anybody over. Don't crash into any other cars. They never bothered. They never told me that. I was never taught that. Why? Because he just figured, hey, that's not necessary. I mean, you know, he just expected the people who are here, you know, they know that much. I don't have to bother even telling anybody that. It's just taken for granted that all these students are going to know that. And, of course, we did. He didn't have to say it. We knew it. We all knew it, right? Just like in the same way my parents, they never told me, don't stab your younger brother with a knife. I don't remember them ever telling me that. Why? Because they just took it for granted that I knew that. So the analogy is that in the same way, Krishna has design the human body and the human psyche in such a way that, you know, because he's just taking it for granted that people are going to understand certain things, you know, about life and what they need to do. You know, I mean, because like somebody might think, sometimes we accuse the Christians, you believe that if somebody doesn't accept Jesus as their Savior, then they're going to go, to hell forever, eternally, and they're just going to be burned in hell eternally. That sounds really cruel and unfair, and that's not, how is that compatible, consistent with a loving Father? Well, some people can also turn around and kind of, throw the same accusation at us that, you folks believe that people are going to, go to lose the human form of life and have to descend into lower species just because they didn't engage in devotional service. Well, most of these people don't even get a chance to hear about devotional service. They don't even get a chance to, properly understand this philosophy. And you think that even without having that opportunity to really come in contact with this philosophy and have it explained to them properly, that, Krishna is going to, God is going to, judge them so severely and punish them like that? Well, so it's similar. It's not as quite as heavy as going to hell and burning and burning in hell forever, but it's still, it's pretty heavy. So once again, the idea being that Krishna is he's done his job. Human beings have like an innate intelligence. So there's an expression, conscience. This is like basically this is a philosophical speculation what I'm indulging in now because it's a way in which I'm trying to understand this point of how it is. So, people do. They have that intelligence and they should, even though it appears that superficially it may appear that, how could they be expected to understand and behave better? They haven't really had it explained to them properly, but they should. They should. And just like, I was expected to know that I'm not supposed to run somebody over with the car or smash it into another car or something like that. People should know. And you could think, but how is it that, they're behaving so much like they don't know anything? People are capable of diplomatic behavior. Just sometimes you might be in a situation where you see some very, person who's really suffering or poor or something. And on one level, I should help that person, or that somebody might approach you for some help. And you're feeling like, inside you're feeling like, should really do something to help this person, but then you don't do it. You just kind of like figure out some way to avoid it, and you diplomatically behave. You behave in such a way that you don't look bad, but at the same time you don't really do what your conscience was telling you to do, which is to help that person. So perhaps that's what human society is doing. They know that they know better, in other words. They know they shouldn't be cruelly and mercilessly torturing and slaughtering so many innocent animals just for the satisfaction of their own tongue. They know that they shouldn't be killing babies in the womb. They know that they shouldn't be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the different sinful-like things that they're doing. But they can't be bothered. And they just diplomatically, they're behaving in such a way as that they're not really even doing anything wrong. I don't know. This is like, if that doesn't satisfy your intelligence, okay, it's an attempt on my part to try to understand how it is that people can be, held accountable so seriously, accountable in such a serious thing, in such a serious way, but superficially it appears that they don't have sufficient education to even be able to make an informed decision. But Krishna knows what he's doing. That's my point. That, and it's not, it might superficially appear unfair, but it's not. And in any event, as devotees, our position is Shastra Chakshus, that whether we're satisfied by that realization, a rationalization that I just presented, or that you come up with on your own, bottom line is that this is what our Shastras say. Our Shastra, and Prabhupada said it on many, many occasions, that people, if they don't engage in devotional service, they are they're running the big risk of descending into the lower species in their next lifetime. So that's, that's how we have to be thinking. And so, following on from that, so we have to, as I started, I mentioned in earlier, that we have to really be thinking how we can save them. And that was, of course, Prabhupada's instruction on, many, many, many occasions, how we can engage them in some devotional service. Prabhupada gave us some, basic guidelines for doing that. He gave, there's three basic preaching programs that he gave us, which are prasadam distribution, harinam, and book distribution. So those are the, three basic programs. And but the general instruction, which includes everything, which is just, preach, preach. And that Papa never specifically said, don't do other things, don't do this, don't do that to attract people to Krishna consciousness. He gave those three programs as what he thought would be particularly effective. But of course, all other methods of preaching are also good. In other words, like somebody might not, because of whatever, they have another service or different considerations, might not be able to even engage in any one of those three. But what's stopping somebody from, call your parents, invite them to the temple, invite your brother and sister, invite your old friends. In other words, the idea is like, every devotee has to be in that preaching mood, has to be thinking like, well, how can I preach? I mean, if you can do one of those things, great. But if you can't do one of those things, it's like incumbent upon every devotee to figure out some way that they can reach out and try to bring people to Krishna consciousness, somehow or another. Now, a devotee might be thinking, well, I'm not qualified to preach, or I don't think I'd be successful. But you got to understand, that's you can't think like that. That's not your call. That's not our call, whether you're qualified or not, or whether you'll be successful or not. That's up to Krishna. Let Krishna be the judge. Our position is as duty, as a matter of duty. We should all be thinking, how can I bring people to Krishna consciousness? How can I spread Krishna consciousness? And if the next thought that comes into your mind is, I'm not qualified, I don't think I'll be successful. As I said, let Krishna be the judge. That's not your call, right? And something we should really be understand. This just popped in my head, this morning or maybe yesterday when I was preparing for this class, that compassion is, sometimes they have this expression, so-and-so, he feels compassion. Yeah, compassion is a feeling, but before it's a feeling, it's a decision. Compassion is a decision. See? You might not be feeling, you might be asked to go out and preach. You might not be feeling, oh, I have to get out there to save these poor conditioned souls. You might be feeling, oh man, isn't there any way I can get out of this? I really don't want to do this. How can I get out of this? But if you go ahead and do it, you're compassionate. You see, you're compassionate. If you actually go ahead and follow through and go out and distribute the prasadam, or go out and Harinam and chant the holy names, or go out and distribute books, you are acting compassionately. You're engaging in a compassionate activity. And eventually, our philosophy is eventually, as you become more advanced and purified, the feeling will follow. That actual feeling of compassion will follow. But initially, it's a decision. It's a choice. It's done with the intelligence. The heart will follow later. But to start off with, it's with the intelligence, you see? So we have to do like that. We have to make that, we have to understand that this is what it is. And we have to make that decision, based upon intelligently understanding the philosophy, we have to make the decision to try to be compassionate, And that's the way this Krishna conscious movement will spread. We have to, if we don't do that, then how's the movement going to spread? We hear repeatedly how we're supposed to try to follow in the footsteps, follow in the footsteps of the previous acharyas. So there's so many different qualities that we have to try to follow. But like, if you stop and think about it, what was certainly one of the most outstanding qualities of Srila Prabhupada was his compassion, right? Definitely. I mean, if Prabhupada didn't have compassion, then we wouldn't be here. So in other words, in order to follow in Prabhupada's footsteps, if somebody wants to try to follow in the footsteps of the predecessor acharyas, the most immediate one, Srila Prabhupada, you have to be compassionate. You have to be compassionate, because Prabhupada was like extremely compassionate. I mean, just something we've all heard many times, but if you stop and think, Prabhupada was 70 years old when he left India. He wasn't in great health. The evident proof of that is that on the boat he had two heart attacks on the way over. So, but he did it. He felt that he was like on one of the first lectures he gave when he was in New York. He said, some lady asked him, he was talking about Vrindavan, and she said, yeah, I could see actually you don't really want to be here. do you like to be in? He said, yes. So I'd actually, Vrindavan is very nice. And he said, but I'm in duty. He said, I'm duty bound. My spiritual master gave me this instruction. So I've come here to give this, you know, message to you people like that. So in other words, it wasn't easy, you know, for Prabhupada to have to do that. I mean, on another occasion, before, when he was trying to get Sumati Maharaji to give him the ticket on the, you know, to make, arrange for his passage on the Jaladuta. So initially, she didn't want to do it. And I can't remember if it was her or the secretary, Choksi, but said to Prabhupada, you know, well, we thought you were just going to be going, we thought you just wanted to go sightseeing, you know. We thought, you know, you just wanted to see America. That they were, I think if it was Sumati Maharaji who said that to him or the secretary Choksi. But anyway, Prabhupada's response was, and I always remember, he said, my life is finished. What is this sightseeing? My life is finished. You know, he was 70. He just said, there's no question of me going over there and enjoying. There's no question of, like, Prabhupada doing what he did for any motive of material enjoyment. 70-year-old body. Prabhupada himself said, my life is finished. Meaning, you know, if you stop and think about it, what does that mean? It means there's no question of me going over there and enjoying sightseeing. How do we enjoy sightseeing in a 70-year-old body? You can't enjoy anything in a 70-year-old body. You know, I'm experiencing that as you get older. All of us who are getting older experience that. You know, this body is like a tube of toothpaste. There's a limited amount of toothpaste in the tube. You know, and as you use it, there's less and less. You know, if you have ever noticed, you know. And when you get down towards the end of the tube, you have to really squeeze just to get even a little enough out on your brush so you can brush your teeth. So that's the way it is. You know, there's a certain amount of pleasure stored up in the body. And, you know, as you use it, it's there's less. I think Bhakti Vikash Swami gives another example in one of his books. I believe it's in one of his books. Maybe I heard it in a lecture he gave about a sponge. You know, you take a sponge and you put it in the water and you take it out. When you first take it out and, you know, set it on the table or whatever, when it's full of the water, you can poke it. And actually, you don't even have to touch it. The water is just like oozing out. You know, the water's oozing out. But even after that happens, if you just poke it, you just go boop, and the water gushes out. You know, and if you squeeze it a little bit, just give it a little squeeze, you know, then the water comes oozing out all over the place. But as the water leaves the sponge more and more, you know, then it becomes harder and harder to get the water out. Until finally, you know, when the water is just about out of that sponge, you can pick up that sponge. You got to pick up that sponge and go, you got to really wring it, you know, to get even a drop out. See, that's what it's like getting older. You know, when you're a kid, I remember when I was a kid, I didn't have to do anything to be happy. I had to take accordion lessons. My parents and I had a friend, we used to go together for accordion lessons. And this was like, we didn't want to go. So we were standing by the bus stop, and it just rained earlier that day. So we're calculating, we're trying to figure out how are we going to get out of this, you know, because we wanted to just go play basketball or whatever, you know. So I saw a big puddle, and I said, okay, come here. And my friend's name was Kenneth. I said, come here. I said, let's stand right here. I pointed to the puddle. I said, that ought to get us, you know, meaning the car was going to come through the puddle, it would splash the water on us, and we'd be all wet, and we couldn't go to, you know, accordion lessons all wet. We'd have to go home. So anyway, so I just said that much. But we laughed about that. he started cracking up. We laughed for about like 20 minutes just on that one little stupid joke. Point being that, you know, when you're a kid, anything, you can enjoy anything. That stood out in my mind. But as you get older, it's kind of like, even you might have the most perfect arrangements for enjoyment. You see all these, like, so many old people, they're going on these cruises and this and that. I actually feel sorry because I could tell looking at the person's body, they ain't going to be able to enjoy anything. You just have to look at a person's body and you can tell what they can enjoy and what they can't enjoy. So anyway, so Prabhupada didn't, you know, it wasn't like for material enjoyment that Prabhupada left India and, you know, came here to preach Krishna consciousness. It was just because he was incredibly dedicated to his following instructions of his spiritual master and compassionate, you know, like that. And so anyway, basically we have to try to follow in Prabhupada's footsteps. Whether we're feeling it, whether we have that feeling, or whether we just have the intellectual understanding, either, both is good. If you're feeling it, wonderful. Congratulations, you've made it. You're an advanced devotee. And if you're not, that's okay. Don't feel bad. Just do it. Just, you know, with, based on intelligence, just do the act, do what act as we're supposed to be acting. Try to help people become Krishna conscious. That's good. You know, you're acting properly by doing that. And in due course of time, with purification and advancement, that feeling will be there as well. I can't see the clock. Can somebody tell me what time it is? Okay, so I'll stop there. I hope maybe somebody has some question or some comment.
Thank you, Prabhu, for a very nice class. I have a question about the verse. Comment on the point that the punishment of time or lack thereof for devotees, and even it's being competent. We understand that the time factor is Krishna.
Time factor. When I see that, I would think that happens automatically. I know Krishna's like time personified, but I really don't. I don't know what's meant by that. So perhaps I could defer to Giriraj Maharaj. He could explain what does that mean. You know, it's Yamaraj is saying they are always protected by the club of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is what Makam is referring to for the benefit of everybody else. Therefore, Lord Brahma and I, and even the time factor, I'm not competent to chastise them. So the question is, what's being meant by that the time factor is not competent to chastise them? Because one might think that, well, that happens automatically. It doesn't seem like there's any, you know, personal consideration there. But Maharaj, you want to help us with that one?
Well, on New Year's weekend here, I spoke on the verse from the second canto, third chapter, that by rising and setting, the sun decreases the duration of life of everyone except those who utilize the time to discuss the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Srila Prabhupada explains in the purport that the rising and setting of the sun for a devotee brings him closer to his eternal life. So because the devotee is engaged in devotional service, the time factor doesn't affect him. It's also like the story that Prabhupada told, Jivo Va Maro Va, that whether he lives or dies, it doesn't make any difference because he'll be engaged in the service of the Lord, either in the present body or the next body. It would have to apply spiritually because materially, we know, the time factor acts.
Jai, thank you. Anybody else have any question or comment? Maharaj.
First, just to respond to your preamble to your talk, when I arrived here, Omkar Prabhu told me that you were scheduled to speak on Saturday. And I thought, great, because I really wanted to hear the realizations of a person who goes out every day and distributes books in such large quantities. I was thinking, what is his realization that, you know, impels him and inspires him day after day, year after year? And I was, I got my answer, that part of my answer today, as I
hope I haven't
thought I would. I did, on that very interesting question that you brought up, I've actually spoken on that subject because there's a verse.
Oh, whether Jamil knew.
No.
Which one?
No, that you covered.
Okay.
how can we say that if someone doesn't engage in devotional service, he's going to fall down? Yeah. The verse is quoted in the purport to the last verse in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And it comes from the 11th canto. Ya esham purusham sakshad atma pravavam ishwaram naba janti avajananti stanad brishta patantyada. The meaning of the verse is, well, it's, yeah, anyway. So, ya esham purusam shakshat, anyone who doesn't worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, atma prabhavam. Atma prabhavam means that he is the source of their creation or their existence, which means he's their father. Naba janti, if you do not serve or worship him, avajananti, or you disrespect or deride him, patanti ada, you fall down. So the commentaries raise the same question. That how can you be following, oh yes, even if you follow all the prescriptions of Varnashram Dharma according to your position, even then, Naba Janti, if you don't serve and worship the Supreme Lord, Avajananti, or you actively disrespect him or deride him, Patanti Ada, you fall down. And they explain that Atma Prabhavam, because he's the source of you, he's your father, you have a certain responsibility to him. So if someone is uninterested in his father, like people say, well, isn't it enough just to be a good person? Why do I have to worship God? Well, the answer is that God is your father. It's your duty to know who your father is. You have a relationship with him. Not only is he the source of your existence, but he's the source of your sustenance. He's the source of everything. So the father's providing the child with everything. The child can't say, well, I don't need to know who my father is. I'll just be a good person. What does it mean to be a good person if you're not even aware of who your father is and all he's doing for you and you're not reciprocating in your position? And therefore, it's not enough to say, well, you know, I'm just a good person. Isn't it enough just to be a good person? Why do I have to worship God? You know, I don't lie, I don't steal, I don't cheat, I don't hurt anyone. Which, of course, it's not true that they don't. So that's one answer to that question that you raised. And one reason, I'm sure you know very well, why this statement, although it resembles the statement of Christians who say, you know, if you don't accept Jesus, you'll go to hell forever, is that we don't have a sectarian idea here. Here the idea is, you have to know who God is. You have to know who your father is. You have to appreciate that he is your father and all that he does for you and reciprocate. This has nothing to do with, you know, Jesus or Muhammad or, you know, this has to do with your existence as a living being. No. But I thought it was a very good point you raised, a very, very good question. And I think your answer was also correct. You know, because we are part and parcel of Krishna, we by nature have all the good qualities of Godhead. And when we come to the human form, those qualities are uncovered to a certain degree, to the extent that it's understood that a person knows without being told certain things. And this verse sort of highlights what it is that we should know, which is we have a creator and we have an obligation to him. And if we don't fulfill our obligation, we're punishable. Hare Krishna.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Because I felt that was an important point, and I didn't. Thank you so much for elaborating upon that. I think it added a lot of additional light onto the subject. That was really nice.
And just one other comment. I thought this. Your statement that compassion is not a feeling or just a feeling, but it's a decision, I thought that was really appropriate. And many people have commented, and it's intrinsic to the definition of bhakti, that love is not a sentiment, but it's a process. So love, when manifested in relation to dependent, it takes the shape of compassion or mercy. With an equal, it's friendship, and with a superior, it's service. So that is it's absolutely right what you said. And I never heard it expressed quite in the same terms with the same force. So I will keep that in my mind at all times.
I have a question on just to take off from Maharaj's point just now. Does that same, and to yourself or Maharaj, does that same degree of responsibility apply to civilized and or uncivilized beings?
Well, like Maharaj said, the human beings have the good qualities and they're uncovered to a certain degree when you come to the human form of life. So I guess that the degree of responsibility would be depend upon the degree of how much those good qualities are uncovered. And Krishna as the super soul would know, because he's the one who's uncovering them. So Krishna knows how much, you know, really what he's given that person to work with. And Krishna as the super soul is watching, okay, I've given you this much to work with, you know, I've given you this kind of this particular body, you have this much understanding, you have this much intelligence, and I'm watching, what are you doing? And if, you know, if you don't perform nicely, then Krishna, if you perform nicely, you're utilizing it nicely, good. And then Krishna can give more intelligence and uncover those good qualities even more. And if Krishna's not pleased, you know, because we always have the free will. So if Krishna sees that we're not performing nicely, then he can be displeased, and of course, and then he could punish that person in accordance. I mean, that's the only thing I could come up with. Because, I mean, obviously Krishna's aware of, he knows exactly where everybody's at, and he knows exactly for that person, what that behavior represents. Does that represent, you know, really rebellious and defiant behavior? Does that represent, you know, an attempt on his part to be very submissive and compliant? Krishna knows, and Krishna will respond accordingly. Did I address your question there?
Yes, but I think usually that question comes up because do we give the same responsibility to a small child as you would an adult?
No. No. I mean, the only comment comes to mind that Prabhupada, I think, on one occasion talked about how the people in India, and this is like, I can't remember the exact words, but I heard this, you know, like kind of through devotees, that people in India are like even, in one sense, more responsible for when they act sinfully because, you know, they get a particular body and they're born in a particular culture where there's a lot of knowledge. And it's like the point was sinning and knowledge is more sinful than when you sin in ignorance. So the more knowledge that's there, then the more you're responsible and the more, you know, you're held accountable for what you're doing. So therefore, an adult being in knowledge, generally speaking, would be more accountable, you know, be more serious if an adult does something that he knows he's not supposed to do than if a child does the same thing, you know, depending upon the, you know, the amount of knowledge like that. Yep.
Yeah, again, the question is, typically in society, people think that this child is not responsible. Why is it in a suffering condition? But we know from the Krishna conscious point of view that there's something beyond just the physical. There's a karmic reasoning there also. So again, it's in material society, generally people think, well, why is this person having to suffer, or why are they responsible for having fallen down or been put into a suffering condition? But from this verse, we're seeing that whether you're not worshiping or even disrespecting, there's a fall down. So my question again was just, what sort of degree of responsibility is there?
Okay, watch that.
In the Mahabharata, there's that story of Mundaka Muni, who was brought before Yamaraj because he had, as a child, had pierced an ant with a straw, and therefore he was going to be punished. And then out of that, the end result was there was a maryada, a change or establishment of new code, that until the child is 14 years old, there is no karmic responsibility. So even though you come into this life with karma that you're suffering or enjoying, in this life, apparently, based on that story, you don't develop any new karma until you get to 14.
Wow, that's interesting. I never heard that before. I heard the story, but I didn't know that. What did you call it, a maryada?
Yeah.
A boundary. Okay, so I guess we could stop there. So thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.